Robin Abrams was a 28-year-old former sheriff's deputy for Will County in Beecher, Illinois. On October 4, 1990, 18 days before her deposition in a case where she was accusing officers in that department of sexual harassment, among other charges, she drove away from her parents' home. Not far down the road, she waved to her father, who was headed in the opposite direction. Robin was never seen again. I'm Ed Denzel, and this is Unfound. Before we get too far into this episode, I think I need to prepare all of you. You're going to hear a lot of disgusting information today. I don't know how else to put it. And you know that I don't sensationalize things. I don't exaggerate. By now, you know the format of the show. I have a theme at the beginning. I go over the facts. I do an interview with either a family member or a blogger or a writer. And then afterwards, yes, I do a little bit of theorizing and hypothesizing. But mainly, this show tries to stick to the facts. So when I tell you, you should believe me, that the interview that you're going to hear, the woman that I talked to, what she is going to tell all of you, is going to at least a little bit shake your belief about how police conduct investigations in the United States. I don't know how else to put it. Because the amount of cover-up, lies, distortions, it's going to boggle your mind. It truly is. And it didn't just happen for a small amount of time. It's actually been going on for over 25 years. So I wanted to state that first. I just wanted to prepare you for that. Second, I don't want anybody who is involved in law enforcement, if you're listening to the show because you enjoy it, I don't want you to think that this show is anti-police. It's not. I'm not going to say it's pro-police either. All I do is do this show and present the facts as I understand them. And that's why in all of these shows, I go out to get the person who knows. And I'll be honest, I do my fair share of research as well. It's not like somebody can come on this show and just outright lie to me because I double check everything. It's kind of trust, but verify. Yes, we have talked about the police. It started back when I had Kelly Murphy on the show talking about how the police don't have enough resources to help the families who have lost loved ones through disappearances. We wonder if they have enough training. Are enough cops on the beat to help these people? Those are always going to be good questions and good topics on this show. But this show goes a little further than that. This is going to be the second show, and I did a show about a month ago where a woman, Kelly Rothwell, who was a police officer here in Pinellas County, disappeared. And why did she disappear? Probably because of another man who was involved in law enforcement. He worked at a prison. In today's case, we have another situation where a woman who was involved in law enforcement has disappeared, and most likely the prime suspect is another man who was involved in law enforcement. I don't plan these things out. I just go where my curiosity, my interests take me. This is not planned. But what runs through my mind is, where are the good cops? Where are the good men and women who were working at the prison with David Perry back in those days when he was committing fraud up there in New York in the early 2000s, right? Where were they? Where are they now? And likewise, in this case, I wonder the same thing. Where were those good cops in Beecher, Illinois, when Robin Abrams disappeared in 1990? I'm still asking that question to this day. And now the facts of the case, and these facts are brought to you by my friend Megan Good and her website, charlieproject.org. On October 4th, 1990, Robin Abrams passed her father on the road in Beecher, Illinois. Nobody knew where she was going or if she was going to meet anyone. However, a half day later, her red 1989 Dodge Daytona was found in Harvey, Illinois, with the doors locked and the keys in the ignition. Her camera was in the car, but there was no trace of Robin. 3 days later, Robin's purse was found in a residential area 3 blocks away from the car's location. Whoever took the purse left Robin's wallet, but took the credit cards. However, those cards were never used. Robin had been dating a fellow married police officer, Anthony Marquez. She was unaware of his marital status. When Robin discovered this, she broke off the relationship. What ensued was a 2-year-long period of harassment by not just Tony, but fellow officers assisting him in his efforts to make Robin's life miserable. However, despite Marquez being the instigator, he managed to get Robin fired from the police force. In response, Robin, in December 1989, filed a federal lawsuit against Marquez and others alleging wrongful termination, sexual harassment, and violation of her civil rights. She was scheduled to give her deposition in the case on October 22, 1990, but vanished 18 days before that. Robin had made statements before she disappeared that if anything happened to her, her family should have Marquez investigated first. Those are the general facts of the case. I get into each one of those and even more with my interview for this show, and I'll tell you who that is in a few moments. But I think I need to issue another warning. This is a very complex case. So please listen as well as you can. Like I said, you're going to hear about police corruption, but you're going to hear about burial sites, neighbor disputes, you're going to hear about the mob, you're going to hear about the shooting up and the torching of a house, and there are going to be many names thrown around like Marquez, Moss, Susie, Bruchette, and all of it in relation to the disappearance of Robin Abrams. So I ask you to listen as well as you can. And it doesn't help, and this is the real kicker for this case, is that the family, Robin's family, didn't find out about any of this until over 20 years later. Until that point, they thought that the investigation was all above board, when it really wasn't. The interview I have regarding the disappearance of Robin Abrams is with her sister, Jody Walsh. Jody has spearheaded the effort over the last 25 years to bring those people involved in Robin's disappearance to justice. I've gotten to know Jody very well. We emailed each other back and forth several times. We are now friends on Facebook, and even though I've never met her personally face to face, I can already call her a friend, and you're going to hear a very passionate woman in this interview, a woman very much like all the other interviews that I've done. This is a person who is not going to stop until her sister's abductors and probable murderers are in jail. I remind you that you can find me on Twitter, Unfound Podcast. You can email me, unfoundpodcast@gmail.com. I'd love for you to join the discussion group on Facebook. It's just called Unfound Podcast. And also, the show can be found at Podomatic and iTunes. I'd love for you to subscribe and give the show a decent review. I now give you my interview with Jody Walsh, sister of Robin Abrams. Jody, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Ed.
Tell the listeners a little bit about Robin, who she was, your relationship with her, and then we'll get into some of the details of her disappearance.
Okay. We grew up in a house. There was 4 girls. Robin was the baby. She was the youngest. Donna, the oldest, then myself, our sister Karen, and me. Our dad was a bricklayer and a part-time policeman for the town we lived in. Mama was a stay-at-home mom. Robin, when she was younger, we had always had a pool, and you could always find us by the pool, in the pool, riding bikes. We liked outside. Robin liked exploring things. She was real, even little girl studious. She liked to read, a lot reading a lot of books. And she loved school, and we loved our baby sister.
And she grew up, she went to high school, graduated. Did she go to college?
Robin was the first one in our family that went to college.
Is that right?
She went to the junior, the community college out here, and then went to Governor State, where she graduated with a bachelor's degree. And she was the first one that went to college in our family. We're very proud of her, mom and dad, and all of us.
Wow. Okay, and you were very close to, were all you four sisters very close?
The older two, Donna and I, were close. There's a four-year gap between Robin and Donna, so we watched out after our little ones, you know, our younger sisters, and, you know, basically when we had together time, we were all together, you know, play Barbie dolls and that kind of stuff growing up, but when we were... My sister Diane and I, you know, we were in school ahead of them, and we'd go and teach school to them when they were little, and you know, that kind of stuff. But
so how many years difference was there between you and Robin?
Six
years. Okay. No brothers? No brothers?
No boys. There's no brothers.
Wow,
no brothers.
That's a lot of estrogen in that family, Jody.
Oh, you better believe it. It was fun. It was real good memories for most part of it.
And so how did she end up becoming a policewoman? How did that all happen?
Well, we'll start by the fact that she put herself through college. She worked at McDonald's. She even became a manager at a few of the McDonald's and worked, you know, worked her way up the rung. And one day this gentleman came in by the name of Tony Marquez. Who was a Will County auxiliary officer. He was 42 at the time. She was, 42, I believe, and she was 28. So he's much older than her. And they hit it off. And, you know, she admired policing because my dad was a police officer.
Right.
And that was something in the back of her mind, I believe. I know she wanted to be a lawyer, but she wanted to do the different things like, you know, become a police officer, see how that is. And then work her way up and, you know, become a lawyer. Her passion was helping distressed women. I'm not going to go into the background of that because both of my parents are gone.
Okay.
But
she
did have a commemorative letter from a group called Groundworks out in Joliet by helping a lady by the name of Miss Brunel. I don't want to give her first name, but she's also missing from Will County.
Oh, my.
But she got an accommodation letter for helping her in the battered women and children. She had a heart for people, and she was always always that way, always helping out people. And she met him there. And
so while she was a manager of McDonald's, she was doing this, like, on the side, like outside of work.
When she was at McDonald's, she met him.
Okay.
And he was a police, you know, auxiliary.
Okay.
And then she got into the academy in Springfield, Illinois, to be a police officer. And she did do that, and she got the accommodation after she was you know, the Will County Sheriff's Police, the office that did hire her, which was one of the biggest mistakes our life ever faced was that, that day.
What around what year did she become a policewoman? What year?
89, she went into the academy, and in 89, she was Will County Police Officer. I believe I'm getting these dates right.
Okay, that's fine.
It's over 26 years.
I understand. Listeners will understand. Great.
A few months before her actual tender as, you know, an interim policeman, before she became full force, she was fired.
Tell the listeners about that.
Robin's boss, I'll just say his first name. His name was John. And him, he was the sheriff, John, at the time in Will County. And his entourage, I want to call them, Tony Marquez and a few other officers that will be named later.
Mm-hmm.
They were all best friends. They grew up together. They went to school together. And so Robin found out that he was married. He told her he was divorced.
Mm.
She found out he was married. They dated for a while, and she found out for sure and broke it off. And that's when the trouble started right there.
Mm-hmm.
Other than the fact that prior to that, he did punch her in the face once, and when she was in the academy, they noticed the bruise, but she wouldn't talk about it because she knew what was going to happen. You know, she kind of had a fear of him.
This was Tony Marquez.
This was Tony Marquez.
So the same guy that, just to be clear for the listeners, the same guy that recruited her to get into being a cop is the same guy who started abusing her once she became a cop.
Yes.
Wow. Okay. Yes. All right.
And through her course of the breaking up and all that, Tony Marquez beat my mom and her. The car mom was driving was a new van, and he beat it in with a baseball bat. She lived out in the Joliet area and had her tire slashed several times. And the baseball incident, Mom and Robin had a court date. And they went to the court date, and they found out that the date was changed conveniently by another judge who happens to be friends of the chain of command, let's just say. Mm-hmm. And this is document. We have the proof.
I mean, I know you. I know you do.
The thing dropped. You know, the case was dropped, so they never got anything out of that. So from then until the day she disappeared, October 4th, 1990, this man, Tony Marquez, had over 105 complaints on my sister. From anywhere from reckless driving, stalking, phone, you name it. He had it. And
Meaning that he didn't have the files charged against him. He had filed them against Robin.
Yes, he harassed her in that way, and it ended up going to court. And my sister stood at court with my mom and jury, 12 of them. They could only do two charges. One was harassment and one was something else. I don't know. Out of all that 105.
Wow.
And mind you, in the meantime, these records I do have of these arrests, several of the people that had interfered with her life to make it miserable were named on those complaints as people that signed off on the reports, that took the reports, that came to her house with their guns drawn to her head, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
That I'll talk about a little later.
Yeah, yes.
But they had gotten her to those two counts, and my sister was found not guilty on everything, not guilty. And the judge at the time who was hearing it was Judge Bua, and he ordered an order of protection for my mother and for my sister against Tony Marquez to stay away from my sister and mother. That was still in effect. It was still in effect till she, you know, left the earth.
I mean,
was not supposed to be anywhere near them. The judge ordered that. That wasn't, now this is an interesting part. Robin and Mom didn't request that at the time. They were there to, you know, get her off, you know, the charges or whatever.
Yes.
But the judge saw through this bull crap, if I can say that.
You can say that.
And said, you know, this is what I'm issuing. Follow it. It was not followed. Not followed. Would you like me to get into a little bit of some of the harassment, my sister?
I think what we want to do is explain what the family dynamics, what was going on as this was going on. What was Robin telling you? Did you live in the area also? Were you somewhere else? What was she telling her mother? You know, your mother, I should say. What was the conversation within the family while this was going on?
Okay. I did not live in the area. I was raising two little children, my two children at the time. But we did have family gatherings. You know, we'd go out to Mom's, and Robin lived in Joliet in her own little apartment, and Mom and Dad lived in Beecher, Illinois, which is about a maybe 45-minute ride.
Okay.
Mom knew what was going on. It happened to Mom. She was in the car when he beat her.
Yeah, right.
You know, and But we were close. I mean, she'd come to the birthday parties, and once in a while she would take my two younger ones, one at a time, because they were, you know, four and like seven or something.
They were
like
a little bit of a handful? A little bit of a handful?
Yeah,
okay.
You know, she has never had children. She's
okay.
Never had kids, so. And I didn't want to overburden her because
sure.
I know how my kids are. You know?
Yes.
Just go and relax and enjoy your time with your auntie. That's your special time,
yeah.
Which they each got to do.
Yeah.
And took them to the ball game. She was a big Sox fan, Cubs fan, and, you know. So we did have that kind of camaraderie after, because I was married young.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be 43 years this November. And next week, this week, it's the 24th.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
And were you fearful for Robin's life at this time, Jody? Were you a little worried about her?
I'm going to say after the incident where she was stuck in the cell in Joliet at one time with 10 male felons uncharged on a Class C violation. And the man that put her in jail, we'll just say Jim, because he was the prison guy there, says, we'll make her the exception to the rule. Stuck her in a cell 10 hours with eight hours with 10 male felons.
And this was because of one of the charges that Tony Marquez had brought against.
Trumped up charge.
Yes, it was.
Yeah. And that's when I had a gut feeling as a sister, something is wrong here. We got to get her out of there. And then my mom started telling us about the time her car was slashed with the tire, you know, her tires were slashed and, you know, running her off the road. And I go, Mom, why didn't, she goes, well, you had your family, your kids to take care of. I'll take care of Robin.
Yeah.
That's how Mama was, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I have to say this on the air.
Please.
I have a bad temper. And if I'd have known what this man was doing to my sister, I might not be able to be sitting here talking to you. And I'll let you guys fill in the blanks there, because this would have never happened, ever happened to my sister, what these people did to her.
Yeah.
I'm not going to stop now either. I'm going to keep going forward to get justice.
What was Robin saying at this time? To your knowledge, was she telling your mother, you know what, I can handle this, or no, you know what, I'm going to move, I'm going to, you know, go move to, you know, Indiana or Wisconsin or something? I mean.
Well, she did move out of Joliet
okay.
and moved in with my parents, and my oldest sister Donna lived there also, and Donna and Mom and, you know, Robin would, Robin, as a matter of fact, took my sister, my mother, and one of Robin's or Donna's girlfriends out to where Tony Marquez worked in Joliet. He had an insurance company and told them this is just probably approximately 2 to 3 weeks before she went missing.
Mm-hmm.
Said, if something happens to me, that's his office, that's who did it. And Mom, they already knew it was Tony Marquez.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Mom and Donna and It was fearful whenever she'd go in the car. You know, you never know where he'd show up or,
right.
you know, what kind of police would be following her and drawing their guns to her head in her own apartment at one time. And five of them came and were telling her neighbors that she was nuts and a lunatic with a gun and, you know, just really bizarre things.
And just so we're clear for the listeners, the reason that this all was going on was because Robin found out she was having a relationship with Tony, and then Robin found out that Tony was married, and so Robin didn't want to be with him anymore, and this was all of his retaliation for this, for that.
That's
your suspicion.
Correct.
That's your suspicion.
Yes, that's our assumption.
Mm-hmm.
And along with that, getting kicked off the police force was a very big part. The man by the name of John, who was running again for re-election for sheriff.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, they fired my sister, okay?
Right.
And, not long before her year was up, they fired her. So she filed a sexual harassment, wrongful termination against them.
Yeah.
And like 18 days before she was to give her deposition to her lawyer's office, she disappeared.
So it was a combination. It was a combination of that relationship and then this lawsuit that she was filing. And she was sounds to me like she was going to win it. And a lot of people were worried about that. So it was a combination of issues.
Yes.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, she had a 6 to 8 hour deposition given on their side for the Illinois state side.
Mm-hmm.
And they all had they all knew what she was, how firm this case was. And
right.
They couldn't have that because he was running for a re-election. And in the meantime, while she was getting harassed by him, she would go several times to this John guy, her boss. And he ended up firing her, saying that she would otherwise bring a bad name to the police department.
Oh, my.
On things that were going on. I mean, completely defamation of character. She had a very strong suit.
Okay.
And I know she would have won it, and these people would have been exposed.
So what happened the day that she disappeared? What do you remember about it? What you remember? And then what are the facts of her disappearing and then maybe a couple days after that?
Okay. My father was the last to see her. They lived in Beecher, and she was going down Goodenough Road, and she passed him. He was coming home from work mid-afternoon, 4 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
And they waved. So he had never talked to her or anything. Of course, she was 28 at the time, and mm-hmm. You know, she doesn't have to tell everybody her whereabouts, goings and comings. Mom and Donna thought that she was just going out on errands. Donna was working at the time, so she didn't get to talk to her,
mm-hmm.
You know, that day leaving.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just here going about my life, working and watching my children.
Yeah.
And I got a call.
She was in the car by herself. Your father did not see anybody else in the car with her. She was alone.
Just her in a red Dodge Daytona.
Okay.
Just her in her car, yes.
All right.
And he did note that she had on a white dress shirt. You could see her dress shirt and her black leather jacket. That's okay. What she, you know, had on.
Okay.
And where she was going, no one knew. She was spotted at a gas station, and Tony Marquez was also spotted there.
Hmm.
Okay. So I get a call at 7 in the morning. And
the next day?
This would be October 5th, okay. 7 a.m.
The next day.
1990.
Mm-hmm.
My sister Donna called and says, you have to come over here. Robin's missing. And I got in my car and immediately went out there.
Did you immediately think that, let's just be honest, what was your knee-jerk reaction when you heard that? What did you think?
Tony Marquez killed her.
Okay. Okay.
That was all of our initial reaction he got to her. And when I got there with Will County Police that she worked for, a gentleman by the name of the detective's name, first name was Steve, and some other people. And, of course, everyone was crying. And, you know, we just tried to hold it together for my mom. And a couple days later, they get a call. They found her purse in Harvey. They found the car. The reason why they got a call, Robin was not reported till the next day,
mm-hmm.
because Harvey, Illinois police called and says, we have your car, your daughter's car here. And there's no sign of Robin.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And how far is Harvey from where she was last seen?
Joliet would be where she was last seen. Mm-hmm. Harvey's. Probably, maybe, I'm going to say, guess an hour away.
Okay.
Towards Chicago.
All right. So not close. Not like right down the street. Okay.
No, not down the street, but it's another county.
Okay.
This would be Cook County, the Harvey area.
Mm-hmm.
And the other would be Will County.
Will County.
The Will County Police Department. Sheriff's Police, yes. When she... The car was found. Supposedly keys were in it. They did find her purse. A lady called our parents a few days later and says, I found your purse. And it had her wallet, you know, and stuff in it.
Mm-hmm.
There was also a camera in the car. There was a camera.
Mm-hmm.
And for years, we were told there was no film in the camera.
Mm-hmm.
And for years, we thought that the state police, because at this time, you got to remember, Robin was a Will County officer who was fired.
Yeah.
So there was a conflict of interest. So a few days later, the Illinois State Police stepped in. Okay. So getting it out of Will County's hands was a good thing because they're the ones that we strongly believe
right.
have been covering it up.
Yes.
So now for 1990 to 2012, we believe the Illinois
just
one, State
one quick question. One quick question. Where was the purse? Was the purse, you said a woman found Robin's purse. Where the purse wasn't found with the car?
No, the purse was found in a lady's yard about three blocks away.
Three blocks away from the car.
From the car.
Okay.
In Harvey.
Okay.
Yes.
It was just sitting in her yard, sitting on the sidewalk.
Yeah, they found the purse and,
just sitting
you know,
there.
The information and called my mom and, you know, got a hold of belongings and,
anything weird about the car? Anything that you remember that just, I mean, we're going to get into how the car got there, but anything weird about the car? Any blood stains found in it? Did they dust it for fingerprints? That
all
kind
right,
of stuff.
All that forensics has been, it is an open investigation, okay?
Mm, yes,
and
of course.
And there's things I can say in that. But I do want to say there was a – I don't know how much of that I can go into. Other than the car, even other than the car after the Will County Police Department went through it, after them, and then the state got it, the car was given back to the car dealership that she had the, you know, payments to. They got the car back.
Oh, my.
So I was told there's evidence in the car that they've been taking, you know, had forensics done a few times. And we'll leave that there. But there was there was evidence in the car.
Okay, great. So what did you find out? There was a witness to the car being there. What can you tell us about that before we get into what happened between 1990 and 2012? Somebody did see the car being parked there.
Yes. A gentleman, an elderly gentleman, through his picture window, because it was a cul-de-sac, and they dropped it off near a street light. So he could identify it, told what it was, said he saw these two gentlemen, and he also faced them in a lineup and pointed them out. This is what we were told. And
I think we're going to have to be a little bit more specific. Actually, we're going to have to be a little bit more specific for the listeners. The car was dropped off by a tow truck.
The car was dropped off by a black tow truck with chrome.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It was initially reported as a red tow truck, and the state police did that to deter any false information.
Okay.
That was a letter I got from the state police stating that fact, that it was a black tow truck and that it was the car was dropped off there by two gentlemen, and Tony Marquez and his stepbrother, John Romo, were the two that he identified in the lineup.
There were the two guys, one of them driving, the other as a passenger, in this tow truck, and were there.
Correct. Dropping the car off on the cul-de-sac where the gentleman lived.
Wow. So was that identification made shortly after Robin disappeared, or was that 5 years down the road, or was that right around that time?
That was right around that time,
okay.
Which we did not know about.
Okay, so now that you just said those words, what happened? So the police start investigating. You think that they're doing as good a job, even though you have your suspicions about what happened. You know, but you didn't know a lot of this stuff because what happened between 1990 and 2012? You actually thought that a good investigation was going on, but what did you find out? What did you think over those course of those years?
I had all trust in the state police. I did not have any reason to doubt them. I've always thought that they were upright, outstanding. That's our state police.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And
they should be above the politics of local communities and, you know, you scratch my back, you know.
In any of the dealings with, you know, with the other municipalities, they're the state police.
Right.
So a couple times during 90 to 2000 and something, we were always asking for updates and, you know, they would have us come in and tell us, you know, some little thing here and there. But it got to be where, it's kind of too old. We have no new clues. we've run out all our, what's the word? The
leads, you know, they've investigated the lead tips come leads. In yes. and, you yes. know, they're doing what they can, they say.
And one statement was made a few times, we're just waiting for someone to confess or find the body. That's what we were always hoping for, a confession or find the body.
What was, can I ask you now that we know, we're going to, listeners are going to find out what happened in 2012. There's a reason, listeners, we keep bringing that year up. But what did the state police tell you? I mean, here you have a guy who was harassing your sister, who had been in a relationship with your sister. She was bringing a lawsuit against him in this police department. He was identified as being in this tow truck that dropped her car off. Is that not enough to, you know, start a grand jury, or, you know, some district attorney out there didn't say, you know what, this sounds like a winnable case. That didn't happen.
You would think so, wouldn't you?
You
and
would.
Actually, the Marquez and Romo were supposed to submit the hair and blood sample, and a court overturned it because they weren't considered suspects. They're considered, as the wording of the police, persons of
interest. POIs, yeah.
Since there was no charges filed on them, they couldn't get the blood and hair samples that they needed for comparison. Mm-hmm. To this day, they still don't have that, as far as I know.
Okay.
And, yeah, with what evidence that I, you know, I'm not even a police officer. I'm not
mm-hmm.
a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
But what we have found out in the, especially starting in the year 2012,
mm-hmm.
I cannot for the life of me figure out why they're not in jail. I just, it's beyond me. It's mind-boggling.
Because,
and I know my sister's not the only person, as you know, in
yeah.
your broadcast,
yeah.
that are going through very similar.
That's
situations.
True. That is absolutely true. True.
Yes.
In fact, the last show that I just had on with Kathy Turkanian, and, you know, and her daughter, her biological daughter that disappeared, it's a similar situation where there's all this evidence and still nothing's been done. And the listeners should know, being that, you know, I do so much, you know, internet research for the show, there are several cases. Never think because you don't have a body that somebody can't be convicted of a murder. It's actually, if you start going through, for example, charlieproject.org, you're going to find several cases where that's happened. It's more common than you think. I wouldn't say it's common, but it's more common than you think. So that's what I start thinking when I start thinking about Robin's case. So 1990 to 2012, you just think they're doing their job. You're being a mother. You're being a wife. You're raising your sons and just going about your life. Just fingers crossed, hoping something good happens.
My son and my daughter.
Son and daughter. I'm sorry.
Daughter.
I apologize. I thought it was two sons, son and daughter. But then what happens in 2012?
In 2012, a private investigating lady by the name of Cindy came to my home to present me with now what I call is my Robin file.
Mm-hmm.
She used to be a police officer. She became a private investigator, and she also worked in Will County for some of the courts in Will County for battered women. She came across my sister's case and thoroughly investigated it. And, what she found is what I've been telling the police for the last, since 2012, of what evidence that we have and how come, why have you not done this? Here's a for instance, Ed. The people named on her lawsuit were never interviewed this past year.
And when you say her lawsuit, you need to be specific here. Robin's lawsuit, they were never named.
The people that were on the lawsuit
mm-hmm.
were never interviewed.
Interviewed. Okay, never interviewed.
Interviewed. I mean, they were never interviewed. The person at one point in time, which we'll get into later, who we know possibly her first grave site was, told them, you're not digging here. You're digging 100 yards away, and that's going to be the end of it. They didn't interview that man till last month or the month before. This is over 26 years.
Mm-hmm.
The man that this is mind-boggling to me. I just, I,
all right,
I don't
we need to line this up for. So Why did this private investigator, did she used to work for Will County? Did she work for Cook County? Did she work for the state police?
She initially worked for Orland Park, which is Cook County.
Okay.
And then she worked for the state's attorney's office in Will County.
Mm-hmm.
After she went through a similar situation, Robin was, and had a lawsuit. And she got out of the department there, and then she ended up, you know, as Robin was an advocate for, you know, women and whatnot. And she came across Robin's case, and it wasn't even dirt that she dug. She just, you know, did a job that, you know, you would think that the state police would have done.
For the last 20 years, for the 20 years in which you thought that they were doing their job, this woman, you know, put this together. I mean, how long do you think it took her to put all of that information together for you?
Well, it's going to be since 2010, so 2 years.
2 years.
But it wasn't constantly working on Robin's specific case 2 years. You mean, you put out FOIAs, you have to wait for the FOIAs and, you know,
FOIAs for the listener are Freedom of Information Act requests, FOIAs, if you don't know what that is for the listeners. You mentioned burial site. Tell us about that. How did you find out about this?
In 1996, a gentleman by the name Art.
Please, you can use his full name. That's fine.
Okay, Art Burchette from Moni, Illinois, got in trouble for having guns and weapons. The police knew him very well. As a matter of fact, Marquez was a good friend of his. Robin even went out to Burchette's property once to look at car engines because they were something about the car, and she at that time was dating him. So he went out there and took Robin with her. So she knew who Burchette was. Mr. Burchette got in trouble with the police in Will County. And he says to get out of these charges, because he was in a lot of trouble with other things, he says, I may know where that Deputy Robin Abrams is buried. And he went on to tell them that one night a car drove down his driveway, a black, like, sedan car, and he didn't know what time it was or whatever. It was very vague. But the next day, he went out to dump his grass clippings because he had a very big yard,
mm-hmm.
and he noticed like a grave, like an indentation, or a grave there.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, I wouldn't be surprised, you know, if that's where they, you know, Robin Abrams is. And the reason why that's connected is because Marquez mm-hmm. and him were very good friends.
Yes.
He wanted to get out of trouble.
And so, did not Burchette sort of have a little bit of a mob connection, too? Did you not?
All right. Mr. Burchette worked the Messino brothers from the city, mm-hmm. Dickie and Clem, one of them passed away. He was good friends with them.
Mm-hmm.
It's just.
And did they not? Did the Messinos not also own a tow truck business?
Yes, the Messinos owned a tow truck business.
So we can kind of tie that into Tony Marquez being seen with that tow truck 6 years earlier. You know, in 1990, you know, dropping off
Correct. Your,
we can connect that. We can kind of all tie that in together. But
Correct.
So the listeners have to keep in mind that Jody and her family did not find out about all of this information that she's going to be telling you from now on until 2012. So she didn't know this. You did not know this was going on in 1996. Nobody ever told you this.
No, we were told in a meeting with James Glasgow, the state's attorney and current state's attorney, something about, did we know Burchette? They asked.
Okay.
I never heard of him.
Mm-hmm.
And about, and we didn't know him. I didn't know who he was. My parents didn't at that time.
No.
And then that was the end of it. And then come to find out in 2012, I got this letter, through the lady, Cindy, who
mm-hmm.
was helping,
mm-hmm.
I ended up putting a billboard up on I-80 in Joliet
mm-hmm.
about my sister with information and that kind of thing that people, you know, do. I only had it up for a month because it was very expensive.
Yeah.
But I got help. I was going to say the very next month, because it was only up a month, a gentleman by the name of Joe Hosey, who works for the Patch. He's a reporter mm-hmm. who did several stories on Robin. You can.
And what year would this have been? Let's just be clear. What year would this have been?
This year would have been 2014.
Okay.
2013, I put the billboard up.
Yes.
And I met the gentleman by the name of Steve, who was actually the very first officer to come to my parents' house back in October 4th of 1990,
right.
who took the report of the missing person.
Okay.
And on January 27th of 2014, he wanted to meet with me. And
Joe wanted to meet
me.
Steve or Joe wanted to meet with you. We just have to clear the pronouns.
Steve wanted to meet with me.
Okay. Steve was a cop who took the initial report. Okay, from 1990. Okay, great.
Correct. And he thought that this was all done and over with because it was taken out of his hands, as you recall, by the state police. So he had to give all his paperwork over to them, and you know whatnot, and. In talking to him, I said, I want a letter, and I want you to sign and date it because I'm going to hold you to what you're telling me. Mm-hmm. And he was also brought before a grand jury in 2014. Nothing's come out of that yet.
Okay.
But you want me to read to the listeners?
Let's just condense this down. Let's talk about what happened out in front of his house, and then how coincidentally he was the guy, the cop who showed up with the car. And then we can talk about the burial.
Okay. So. My sister had an altercation in front of that Steve's house back in August of 1989 or 90. I can't remember. And it was my sister out in the front in her car. She was pulled out of her car, handcuffed, pulled out of her car. He came out, her and her scream. They were beating her head against the car. The people I'm referring to is the two police officers. Tony Marquez, who was an auxiliary at the time, who remember at this time also had an order of protection to stay away from my sister.
Yeah.
And a gentleman by the name of Phil Fabo, who was his best friend, who also worked for Will County Auxiliary. And then another Will County officer by the name of Carol Szczynski, also came in a white unmarked van. And she says, help me, Steve. He goes, what's going on out here? And that's when Mr. Conigram, and in this letter I'm reading his exact words.
Steve.
He said, he heard Lieutenant Szczynski state something to the effect of somebody ought to kill this bitch, referring to my sister Robin.
And coincidentally, what is the coincidence here that the cop who ends up being the first one on the scene when her car was found, that this happens out in front of his house like months before that. I mean, that is some crazy coincidence. I absolutely believe it's true, but listeners really need to understand how strange that is.
Yes. And he's the only one that came forward with a bunch of information. I have his letter.
Yeah.
Which he also went to the grand jury in Joliet. It was a closed grand jury. You don't know what they said, and I have no idea. But he also gave me the information of the Messina Brother tow truck. It was dropped off in Harvey. He gave me the information about when they came to the location and said the gentleman by the name, I'm giving his name, John Moss, the deputy chief, says, you're not digging here. You're digging 100 yards
away. Let's
make
sure we're clear on that. Being that we mentioned Art Bruchette, he said somebody came to his property, just to go over this because that was a couple minutes ago now. It looked like somebody buried something on his property. And
right.
He told the cops about this. They went out to dig in 1996 or 1997. And this Steve guy was there who was writing this letter, who was the first guy on the scene for her car in 1990. And John Moss would not let the guys dig in the right place. Tell them about that. Tell them about that more intricately on that.
It was Deputy Moss. He was on the scene already with a female reporter from the Joliet Herald.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is the possible location indicated by where Bruchette said the grave might be.
Mm-hmm.
But upon arriving there, they were told Mr. Steve and mm-hmm. his other people that came because they got the warrant.
Mm-hmm.
We were ordered by Chief Moss to dig in a location where Bruchette indicated was not the grave, but a depression caused by a broken drain tile. We protested that the grave was in an area about 100 feet away.
Mm-hmm.
But by orders of John Moss, he says, dig there, and that's going to be the end of this. And that's what happened to that part of it.
And, of course, they didn't find anything.
Right, right.
Okay.
And then I'm going to read a little bit further.
Okay.
After the election was over.
In 1990.
In 1990, in November, Fitzgerald
okay.
was now the new sheriff, and Moss was no longer deputy chief, so they executed another search warrant on the property, and subsequently,
you and I both have, we've had problems with this word before in our conversations before, listeners,
yes,
you should know. Subsequently, and we should clear up, this is 1996 that this election happened for Fitzgerald. But subsequently,
1990, the election.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, you're correct. I apologize.
Okay.
It was 96 that the election. No, 1996 is when they went to the gravesite.
Right.
In 1990, the election was when Fitzgerald fired Tony Marquez from the auxiliary.
Okay.
And then they go back after Moss was no longer deputy chief
with
another search warrant.
Okay.
And found the grave site where Chet told us, but there was no body. But evidence of a shallow grave depression appeared.
Mm-hmm.
And she might have been there. And
they moved her after that first dig.
Right.
In 1990. Just so we're clear, Art Bruchette in 1996 gets caught. While he's talking to police, he tells them, you know, back in 1990, this people came onto my property in the middle of the night. I think they buried something there. Right? Right?
Correct.
Right.
Yes. And so supposedly, and to date, now it's 2016, we did not know about those areas until 2012.
When
we found out much of it.
Right.
We have the first female detective on her case. Her name's Anna.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe it's been a slow process, and it's very hard for a family to put their trust into an entity that for several years covered it up. And we had our ups and downs, but I'm praying with all my heart that she is the one that's going to really break this, because she's working on it very hard. They have gone. Well, we have a second.
Let's talk about the second location. Before we get into that, there was not just this letter from Steve that was signed. You have a letter from a guy who is called Joe, although that's not his real name. We don't want to use this second property owner's last name. We'll just use his first name, okay?
Okay.
All right, we'll just say Jeff, and we're just going to leave it at that. But Joe told something to the cops. Once again, this is in that time that you thought everything was hunky-dory. You know, they were going about their business. But there's this guy, Joe, that also made a statement to police. What did he say?
No, actually, I need to correct you there.
Okay.
When we had found out, we ended up with a website, Find Robin and Help Find Robin.
Mm-hmm.
I also got a post office box.
Okay.
And on February 24th of 2015, I get a letter in the post office box from a gentleman named Joe.
Wow.
And he said he may know, have the location where Robin might be buried. And he proceeded to tell me the story of his friend by the name of Jeff, who lives in Piatone, Manhattan area, off of Joliet Road.
Mm-hmm.
We won't give the exact
address. No, we're not going to give the exact address.
But Joe's friend, who lived on the property.
Mm-hmm.
Before Jeff. Yeah, Joe's friend.
Mm-hmm.
Jeff lives on the property, but one day, Joe had a very good police friend who was also named on several of Robin's report by the name of, his last name I'll say is Farmer. He's no longer with us.
Okay.
He died. And do you want me to go into what?
I want you to tell the story, and you just tell the story. That's why you're here. You just tell the story.
I'm going to read the last paragraph or so of Joe's letter.
Okay. Great.
Joe had a Will County Sheriff Sergeant officer friend that died last year, which would have been 2014, which he didn't want to name, but I already did. Joe was telling him of the problems that his friend was having with a building on his property, harassment from officers. The gentleman's house was burnt down. The gentleman's house had gunshots fired through it. And his friend told him about Officer Soci. Here's another name.
S-O-U-C-I. That's how you spell it.
S-O-U-C-I-E.
I-E, okay.
Who had friends that were farming the field of Jeff. Jeff bought the property, and for years prior to that, the farmer let the friend of Soci farm his land.
Yes.
And he told Joe that he wouldn't be surprised if Soci didn't have something to do with the disappearance of the former Will County deputy, Robin Abrams. He said Soci was a part of that group, naming Marquez, Coppice, which is another name to remember, and was a crony with Paul Coppice, which was the Will County Sheriff's Police at that time. He stated that he was not a straight and honest guy. Joe fully believed that his friend was telling the truth regarding, you know, the situation with Robin, and that he felt the need to get it off his chest and because it was bothering him. So he passed on the information to me. So we looked up, and sure enough, on the Internet, which I really appreciate, you find a lot of information. The gentleman's house was burnt down. The gentleman, his house was shot up.
Yeah.
And the reason why Soci was vehement to not allowing Jeff build, he wanted to build, the whole thing that started it was this barn that he wanted to build in the back of his property. And they came up with so much resistance. He couldn't get permits. He couldn't, you know, his house got burned. I don't know if that's all, you know, it just seems strange to me.
Yeah, there's a lot of drama regarding just the building of one simple building.
Correct.
And this is out, you have to understand, this is out in the middle of nowhere. This is not downtown Chicago.
This is very rural.
Yes.
Very rural.
Farmland.
Area. Yes.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And so we have two locations now where they had her from 1990 to 1996, where she was supposedly moved. I got to say supposedly.
Yeah.
So these people, I mean, I don't believe that there's people that would, well, maybe there are, that would come to you and, you know, give you information on your sister, you know, your dead, your murdered sister. Why would they make them up? You know, why would they say, you know, and put these names? I've never heard of these people. But then when we start looking into it, Soci was affiliated with Will County. It all ties in. I mean, even,
so let's just break this down for the listeners real quick, because there's so many names, so many locations. It's a very complex case. I just want to break this down. What Art Bruchette said was he believed that there was something that was buried on his property. The cops went out to dig it up, and Moss would not allow them to dig in the right location, so nothing was found. So the suspicion is sometime after that, before they could go back, those same people who might have put Robin's body there went there, dug her up, allegedly, and brought her somewhere else. Once again, now we're talking about this second location, okay?
Correct.
It was buried there with, you know, whoever, the owner, the landowner's permission, or these other people who were farming on the land's permission. But then this Jeff guy, who was a truck driver, comes along. He buys the property. There's this agreement that these other guys can still farm on it. They have some disagreements, and you can find, once again, like you said, you can find out on the internet. But then when Jeff wants to do some things on the property, he's the second. He was not the owner when Robin's body might have been buried there. He was the owner afterwards. that he was being harassed and his house was being shot up. And then in January 8th, and I have the, I think it was January 8th or January 14th, 2014. So that's just a couple years ago, but 24 years after Robin disappeared, his house gets burnt down. Right? That's how
his house was burnt down on July.
January. It was January of 2014. The bizarre thing about this, the listeners should know, and I think you knew this already, is that as of you and I doing this show, November 2016, that house has still not been rebuilt.
Correct.
Now, you've had a chance. We're not saying Jeff's last name, but you've had a chance to talk to him. What do you feel comfortable saying about your conversations with Jeff?
I have no reason to disbelieve this gentleman. Like I said, I've never met him before. But the circumstances with the Stosi, who was, you know, neck deep in with Will County. I mean, there was a lot of there, and there still is a lot of cover-ups in Will County. And you know, since it started to for what 22 years, they got away with it, what they thought. But now, you know, I've been getting to do interviews, like with Roseanne Tejas on CBS 2 News in 2014, and especially people that you, I'm so grateful to you for helping us families have a voice, because the victims don't, or their voice. So stuff started happening after 2012.
Yes.
No, 12. When I started, I can't say that anything did happen between 1990 till then, until we started, you know, letting them know, hey, we got a location. We got a location where my sister's possibly at. Go get her. We have a location. We have eyewitnesses that put him in the, you know, this and everything that we had, they've had, except the second location, which they do now have. Mr. Our state's policeman, Leo Schmitz, was in my home in February of 2014. I gave him the letter. They all know. They had that letter. They had the letter from Steve from the first location. And Anna has been working diligently. Let's hope that this carries through to, you know, to have resolve to have justice for Robin. And I, when I first met Anna, because there's been many, many names and either retired or sent to another location. Once they start getting you feel comfortable with them, you know, your voice is hopefully being. No, it didn't happen until Anna started, you know, coming into the picture. And one of her supervisors, but I'm going to just say the name Jeff. He came to my house in January.
This is a different Jeff.
This is a Jeff from the State Police Department.
Okay.
And here's the thing. I gave them all this information. We went to the FBI. I got escorted out of the FBI by two big FBI agents because the wording says missing person. If it was a murder, they would help me. But I kept going back, and I finally ended up getting escorted out by the FBI. That was a scary thing. But I'm doing this for my sister. Someone has to speak up for her. And then the Jeff from the Illinois State Police and Anna came over, and I was not going to give him or them any more information. I put a folder together, and I wanted them to sign it and date it and say, now you have this information, so you're not going to tell me you never heard it before, you never got it, because that was the runaround we were getting for you know, 4 years after that, or 2 years.
2 years.
And me and that Jeff had a little bit of confrontation. I actually kicked them out of my house. They told me that it was just hearsay. I was going on hearsay. I mean, it's a theory. And I'm thinking to myself, well, wait a minute. Aren't there people that give you information that you're going to go and check on? I mean, this would have been something you would have gone and checked on and not just, you know, tell me that I'm a lunatic, because basically, you know, what they were, not her so much, but him. And
It only becomes hearsay if it's in court. I mean, until that point, it's a possible lead. And now, if they follow the lead and doesn't go anywhere, then you just say, well, might have just been a rumor. But you don't know that until you actually look into it.
Exactly. And that's what the problem I was having was no one would be good. I actually, Hiram Grau was the prior state police chief, and I was in constant contact with them. With one of his, with his chief of staff there, Eric. And one day, I was so mad, I got on the phone because no one was listening to me, and I called, and Eric had another gentleman. It was a three-way call. This is the response that a missing person's family got from the people that were that I was hoping was going to help us with our sister. The words out of their mouth, and I made them say it three times. They told me, this was right after I kicked Jeff out of my house, and gave, you know, they refused to take the information, which they've had. We've given it to the FBI. We've given it to every, you know. They told me if I keep saying what I'm saying and doing what I'm doing, I can go to jail for perjury. Three times I had them tell me that. I mean,
you're not under oath. You're not under oath. You can't. Well, I mean, it may be slander or libel, but it's surely not perjury.
Well, I knew that. I mean, and I'm thinking to myself, well, why am I on trial here? I'm not the one that murdered my sister and have evidence to go after, you know, to go look. And I told them, really? So that ended the conversation with them. So I you know, kind of felt hopeless there, but still clinging to hope and prayer and believing, I am going to get justice for my sister. And I just want to encourage every single case, and you've done a few on your podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
There's many more.
Yes.
Never give up. Right. Somebody will come forth. It'll happen. Just please, never give up. And what I'm going through, I've also reached out to, there's other places besides the police department. And if I could just share this with the listeners, for instance, a gentleman by the name of Tad Dibiase, D-I-B-I-A-S-E, you can Google him.
Mm-hmm.
He's a lawyer for no body cases. I contacted and reached out to him, and he said he would love to do this. And here's the problem I ran into. He said in all his years of doing it, this department, which was the Illinois State Police, was the first department that would not accept this help. Now, to me, that speaks volumes. This man, with the information we have, not pertaining to the body, because we don't have that yet, but pertaining to everything else, drawn up to it, this man, he could be in jail right now facing what he deserves.
Tony Marquez.
By the name of Marquez, correct. I reached out to a group called NecroSearch, which is out of California. Those are forensic people. They would do it for free. Wouldn't cost Illinois taxpayers a dime. I reached out to the VIDOC Society, which is out of Pennsylvania. They're retired professionals that take on cold cases. Yeah. I reached out to another group by the name of American Investigative Society of Cold Cases, a gentleman by the name of Kenneth Main. And I don't know if you've ever heard of Dr. Henry Lee, but he's the leading forensic pathologist in the world. He teaches quantum.
Anybody that's old enough to remember the O.J. Simpson case surely remembers Dr. Henry Lee. Yeah.
Okay. I met with these people back in 2014. I went to their conference, and they want to help. They said they would definitely help. And here's another thing. It wouldn't cost the taxpayers a dime. But every response back from them was, without the police cooperation, we cannot get involved in the case.
And Illinois State Police will not give them permission.
Will not give them permission. So here's what we're trying to do. In regards to these people that I mentioned, we're trying to get a law passed. So that people of murdered victims or missing can get their own outside agencies to help and assist with the case. Because I know 100% in my heart my sister's case would have been done and justice would have been served by now if we had the cooperation. We're trying to get a law passed through and doing that for all of us. I mean, it's not just for Robin, but it's for all of us, for Molly Young, and the names can go on and on. And that's what we're working on now as we speak. And, you know, just never give up. There's going to be justice. There's going to be hopefully that ray of sunshine will come real soon.
I want to ask. I want to go back and ask you a little bit about Jeff, the landowner. Okay. Like I said, you've talked to him a couple times. Once again, we're not saying his last name. What is the reason that he's given you that, even though his house was burnt down in January of 2014, that it's still not been built yet? What's the reasoning there?
The holdup is the township will not give him building. There's a fight between the town, mm-hmm. the insurance company, and, you know, the entities that are involved in him to be able to replace his home. Mm-hmm. And those circumstances I'm not real clear on yet.
And just so we're also clear, even though I know we talked about this the last time before we did this interview, we still don't know what the actual cause of that fire is. You know, the fire department hasn't come out. It was an electrical fire. Or, you know, he left the stove on or something like that. We don't know what the reasoning for this fire is yet.
No, we do not.
We don't know. They probably know what it is. It's just not public information. And I can tell you that since you and I talked the last time, I've tried to look into that and I could not find anything, you know, regarding this. So the circumstances of that by itself are a little suspicious. Usually when somebody has their house burnt down, they get it built again, you know, within a couple years. So there's right. that. The other question I'm sure the listeners are going to be wondering is, here you know this Jeff, who's this landowner.
Yes.
Have you thought about going onto that property yourself, getting somebody who owns a backhoe or something, and maybe just probing around about possibly where her body might have been buried, even if it's not there anymore? You know, once again, this is just a theory.
Well, I did have permission, and I did meet with Jeff on his property,
mm-hmm.
and there was a group of dog handlers that came out with me. In the initial, you know, I don't know how credible they were. They just wanted to help, you know. But here's what I was told. They found nothing, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what I was told by the Illinois State Police. Because now, yes, I'm sitting here with two locations. Why didn't I go dig up my sister, correct? Here's what they told me.
Yeah.
They told me that if I was involved in that in any way, that it would hinder their defense of, you know, the investigation to where they took it to court and say, oh, by the way, Jody, to have any ties in with the finding of my sister would not make an easy job for the state police to have all the facts. They say that, you know, that people could tamper with it or whatnot. So they advised me not to get, you know, for my own safety also, to be going over to any, you know, because I've been on both locations, once with the people with the dog, and the other one I was on just walking around, and I had the permission from the people that were renting it at the time. Now we cannot go on that property because that first property, they said, we're not allowed on. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, no crime scene was, you know, the areas were not secure. I mean, they're not secure to this day.
Yeah.
And other than going to get her myself and have it over with, their reasoning to me seems logical. I don't want to do anything to hinder having justice for my sister. You know that. Everyone knows that they wouldn't want to do that. But I do appreciate you letting our voices for them be heard, because this isn't going to go away, Ed. I'm not stopping until my sister...
We need to, Ed. We need to... The thing is, we're getting toward the end of the interview, but we haven't pointed out one of the major things. Tell the listeners about what Tony Marquez's own wife said about him.
This was a phone call we received back in January 2012 by a gentleman out of the Will County State's Attorney's Office by the name of Dave. He read to myself and my husband the exact statement that Tony Marquez's wife, Arlene, told them which the gentleman's name was Ken Coppish, you told to, mm-hmm. who was state police, that she knows.
What year would you? Tony what year Marquez, did she make this statement? What year?
This was in 1990.
1990, okay.
Supposedly 1990, yes.
Okay.
That she knows Tony killed my sister Robin because Tony told her this. She told the policeman, it was in the statement. That statement was read to us. I says, oh, well, then why is he not around? Well, they can't do it because of the law, because if you're married, you can't testify against your wife or your husband.
Okay, that's not how that law works.
Well, this is, you know, here's the thing, Ed.
Yeah.
She's not home. She's not missing. She's not on a vacation in Florida.
Yeah.
She's dead.
Right. Yeah.
It should be changed from missing to murdered, number one. And Tony Marquez should have the pressure on him. I mean, a few months ago, they went and interviewed him again, the state police, Dan and them. They lawyered up right away. Mm-hmm. So now, you know.
Yeah, we should say for the record, even though she told the police that she thinks that her husband murdered Robin back in 1990, she's still married to him 26 years later.
Correct.
That's crazy. That's one unique correct. Relationship.
Yes.
Wow. Wow. And well, so Tony Marquez, what has Tony Marquez been doing over the last 26 years? He got fired from being a cop because of this Robin's, you know, what she said about him. What has he done since then? How's he running? How's he handled his life?
Well, he's been doing pretty good for himself. He has an insurance company. I don't know if he's retired from that yet. An investment company. He was also actually named Outstanding Hispanic Member of the Crest Hill Chamber of Commerce. And when I found that out, I called Crest Hill and I gave him a little information about Mr. Marquez.
I bet you did.
And they weren't too happy about, you know, what they have on there. You know what I mean?
Mm.
You know, you murder somebody, you go out and, you know, nothing happens to you and you got all your buddies in your pocket. No, there's a similar situation going on like that in America right now. And I'm telling you, we are patriotic. We're not going to put up with that.
No.
And I'm a sister of a murdered victim.
Yeah.
Is that how I want? I'm a murder sister. Help me out here, Ed, because I'm getting upset when I think about this.
You're
a murder victim.
Yeah, you
who
are.
Who has not got justice.
No, you
was
haven't.
A police officer, and, you know, it's not right. And the answers are right there, and they need to do their job, which I hope Anna's doing.
And what you're saying is all these people that we've mentioned the last name of a guy named Moss. We've mentioned the last name of a guy named Susie. We've mentioned some other last names. But you also have a couple women who have been in, this isn't like a good old boys club. This is a good old girls club too. There's been some female police officers who've been a party to all of this as well.
Oh yes, there has.
So they can't even stick up for their own fellow female cop. They chose to go with these guys.
And the irony of this is one of the lady officers that pulled a gun to my sister's head when they were arresting her for some trumped up charge. She had a lawsuit against the very same police that she worked for. And that lawsuit was dropped. I guess they paid her off and either that or she was in fear for her life and just went along with it. My sister would have never done that. She would have never done that, but one lady, stand right in there, we had a gun to her head, knowing what Robin was going through, because she went through it herself, not to the same extent, obviously, went through it herself, and then to come find out Robin's murdered, and she's never come forward. I hope that's eaten at her conscience.
She just continued to be a cop, she's retired now, and she just will not say, and she's not the only. I remember there were a couple different female police officers, but one in particular, like you said, that had drawn the gun on your sister, Robin, you know, at one time. But there's been a couple female officers who've decided to, you know, lawyer up or just not say anything. And that's disgusting.
Well, one of them actually was harassed so bad, they had to change her name, and she's out of state now. in a mental institution because of what they'd done to her, because of the fear she went through and everything she went through in her life because of them. She's actually cracked.
Wow. Jody, how can people help you? Where can they find you, your website, you know, where you are on Facebook? How can they find you so my listeners can help you out and, you know, maybe we can, you know, make some, you know, shake something up in this case? How can they reach you? How can they find you?
I would love it. We have a couple websites, Find Robin on Facebook and Help Find Robin on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
Just Google her name, Robin Abrams, A-B-R-A-M-S. There's many articles on her. I suggest you look at the interview back in 2000, I believe, 14 with Roseanne Tayes or 12. She did a very good audio of it.
Is that on YouTube or where is that? Is that on your website?
You can find that on YouTube or on possibly still on our website because sometimes, you know, they take it down. And
okay.
And I ask that you pray, and I ask that the people that have circumstances similar to ours, drop us a note in there. And there's a bunch of us that we actually have little, like, meetings, not meetings, but little rallies to remember our family. One is going to be coming up December 1st for a young lady by the name of April Zane, who back in the 70s from Frankfort, Illinois, which is also Will County, disappeared as a young lady. And we're going to have a balloon launch. Her sister, Sharon Rose, is putting that on. But and also, you're not alone. There's a lot of us out there.
What's the next marker in this case? Did you not tell me something about you're going to let the FBI do their work, but if something doesn't happen by March or something, did you tell me that in our last conversation? What's going on there?
Yes, I did.
What's going on? Tell the listeners about that, and then we'll wrap this up.
Okay, we have another meeting scheduled with the Illinois State Police, Anna, and the detectives working on her case. By then, they're supposed to have had interviewed all the people, got all their ducks in the row, gone to the properties, and have a complete synopsis. By that date, I had several questions we wanted to answer, wrote it down for them. I'm telling you right now, by that date.
What's the date again?
It's in, I believe, March.
Okay. March 2017.
Correct.
Okay.
Sometimes they postpone it. We've been postponed many times. But I'm saying by the next meeting, March or May, I forget what they said. Mm-hmm. They said they needed time, even though it's been 26 years.
Yeah.
And we've got all the key pieces that they needed to. I am going to start I will have a press release. I will have names, locations, a port. I will have it all. Mm-hmm. I will even have her handwritten pre-deposition letter that she wrote and her lawyer gave us right before she was to go in to give her deposition for our side, because she already gave it to the state police side. After that happened, she disappeared.
Yeah.
Everything that you would need to know that I know, and then you, the public, we, the public, we can demand them to do their job, to arrest this man, to get justice for Robin, and to let them know these people are somebody's mother, somebody's sister, somebody's uncle, somebody. These are our family members, and we will not be quieted till their justice comes. And that's what we're trying to do with the law to help us do, working on that with Terry Bryant down south with Larry Young for his daughter, Justice for Molly. And I just ask that you guys, we can have a wonderful new year with lots of answers and a lot of hurt being healed by doing the right thing and bringing justice to our families.
Jody, thank you for joining me and my listeners on Unfound.
Thank you very much, Ed.
And that was my interview with Jody Walsh, sister of Robin Abrams. Jody wanted me to send a shout out to Angel Casper. Angel assists Jody in compiling all of the info on Robin's case. Angel has also helped Jody with website work and computer work. And her name came up after the interview was over. And so Jody wanted to make sure that Angel was acknowledged. During this interview, we kind of glossed over something, probably a somewhat important point, and that would be, what did Tony Marquez say he was doing at the time that Robin disappeared? He says that he was with his buddy John Romo, and he was at his cousin's bar in Joliet, Illinois, the entire day. So, of course, he's saying he had nothing to do with Robin's disappearance, despite that witness saying that it was at least Tony Marquez who was driving the truck that dropped off Robin's car. But Tony Marquez's alibi has never been broken in the last 26 years. Something else that I thought needed cleared up, because I think both Jody and I both got confused regarding this. And this was what Art Bruchette said in 1996. So I'm going to give you the timeline to you so you can understand it. Art Bruchette owned a piece of land in 1990. Not long after Robin disappeared, he says that somebody came onto his land the middle of the night and buried something. But he didn't say anything to anyone, probably because, well, let's just say he had friends who buried things like that. Then in 1996, when he himself got into trouble with the law, it was during the interview with police that he said that back in 1990, I think he was looking to help himself out with his own troubles. He told the police that back in 1990, once again, when Robin Abrams disappeared, that somebody had come onto his property. So at that point in 1996, the cops went out and tried to dig this spot up on his property. This was headed up by, if you remember, the policeman whose first name was Steve, who Jody actually got to talk to a couple times. He was also, coincidentally, the guy who was the first cop on the scene at Jody's car in 1990. But you remember what happened was they got there, and Deputy Sheriff Moss, once again, we have to differentiate. Steve works for the local town, whereas Moss works for the county. The county sheriff would not allow Steve and whoever else showed up with him to dig in the right spot. So they were forced to dig 100 feet away, 100 yards away, and nothing came of it. However, later, Deputy Sheriff Moss, and this is all under the administration of Brendan Ward, who was the sheriff of Will County at the time, Moss, it is believed, moved on. Sometime between Art Bruchette's first interview when the warrant was supposed to be executed and they couldn't, at some point Moss left, retired. Then, again, Steve and his people went out there, and that was the time that they dug in the correct place, but they found nothing. It is in that time span between the first dig and the second dig that it is believed, if you believe that Robin was buried at that first location, that she was then moved to the second location. I don't know if that was perfectly clear during the interview. One more thing about the burned down house. I'm not going to give you the location of that. I'm not going to give you the landowner's last name. Then I'm not going to give you the actual address. But let me just put it this way, is that I've told you that the house is already burned, is still burned down as of this date. And you know the general area of where this all happened, with names being thrown like Beecher and Harvey and Joliet. And if you do a Google map search, you will eventually find it. In fact, you will find it through both the satellite view And street view, because the house is still sitting there waiting to be knocked down while all the paperwork is figured out. And I said in the interview, and I'll say it again, being that it's still standing is suspicious to me. That he hasn't built a new house in its place is suspicious to me. So if you do your own search, like I know so many of you like to do, you will find it. Where I think this case needs to go from here is pretty obvious. As Jody stated in the interview, that she's going to wait on these FBI reports, but also with the proper technology and I suppose some financing as well, you could get somebody to go out there to the original location, the Art Bruchette location, and dig down to where Jody was allegedly first buried and collect dirt samples to find if there's any blood in that or any DNA in the dirt at that location. Now, of course, if she's wrapped in plastic, I mean, this is so morbid, but that's what we do on this show. We have to talk about these things that I don't know what they could do. However, if it's some other situation in which she was buried, then they might have some luck. So maybe they'll get that done, and maybe at the second location, they can exactly determine maybe where she might have been put there and figure it out. But there are some buildings on that property now, and it's going to be a little more difficult, I think, there. But I will always be here for Jody Walsh and her family, and I will hopefully be able to give you an update on this case sometime in 2017. Until then, I hope you continue to listen. Like I said before, you can find me on Twitter, Unfound Podcast. Find the show at Podomatic and iTunes. Please subscribe. Please join our discussion group on Facebook, the Unfound Discussion Group. And you can email me, unfoundpodcast@gmail.com. I'm Ed Densel, and you've been listening to Unfound.